The Sunstone Foundation presents The Mormon Woman as Writer, recorded live at the 1989 Sunstone Symposium, held August 23rd through 26th in Salt Lake City, Utah. We take you now to the University of Utah campus where the program is about.
Is this microphone on? Hello? I just put someone's ears out. Is that what you're telling me? This session, The Mormon Woman as Writer, is sponsored by Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought. We are very happy and pleased to have this wonderful paper and sponsor it by Phyllis Barber. Phyllis holds a BA degree in music from San Jose State University, and then she went clear across country to Vermont College, where she has a Master of Fine Arts in writing. Phyllis Barber is a writer of short stories, book reviews, articles, and a novel, and The Desert Shall Blossom, which placed first in the 1988 Utah Fine Arts Literary Competition. She has published in many national literary magazines such as the Kenyon Review, North American Review, Fiction International, the Cheriton Review, and among others, and received special mention in Pushcart Prize 13, 1988, for The Whip, a short story which appeared in Dialogue. She has also published widely in the state of Utah in Holiday, Network, Neo, Dialogue, Sunstone, Weber Studies, and the Deseret News. A collection of her short stories, The School of Love, is due out in the spring of 1990 from the University of Utah Press. She is one of the founders of the Writers at Work Conference, held in Park City every June, as well as the mother of three teenage sons, and the wife of David Barber since 1964. Ms. Barber's essay, The Mormon Woman as Writer, will be published in the Dialogue Special Women's Issue, which is forthcoming in late 1990.
I want to thank all of you for being here. This is early in the morning. I appreciate very much your presence. I will preface my paper with a short story entitled Almost Magnificence. She had been magnificent, almost. But now trouble was she leaked at the edges. Maybe somebody hadn't sewn the seams straight enough. God's sawdust doll, dripping flakes of sawdust. For a while, concerned about the litter, God hired somebody to follow her around with a whisk broom. But that proved a full-time job, and people had their own responsibilities. So God said, "Gee whiz, you'll have to take it from here, honey. I've got a lot to do, more dolls to make." So she just leaked around town, incrementally. Trouble was, after a while, the leakage affected the order of things. Her husband couldn't sleep at nights for all the sawdust in the bed. He disappeared. Her child, allergic, sneezed too much and had to be asked to leave. Her brain slipped down to the esophagus, her heart sagged, and her uterus got stuck in a knee joint when it finally gave way to the termite-like excavation. "Mama," she cried like a baby cuddles. "Mama." But her mother was gone, blown away like a crisp autumn leaf. "Dada," she cried. Not like a baby cuddles, but sort of. But her father was gone too. So here was this almost magnificent lady walking around town, saying "mama" and "dada" and leaking. People felt sorry for her for a while. After all, she had been beautiful, and her mother had always dressed her in lace and Mary Janes. But when she started to wear banana peel skirts, fresh cherry earrings, and half-apricot pasties, and started to say, "woo-wee," people shook their heads and wondered. She thought about taking a job at the new health food restaurant in town because her outfit would be appropriate for the lunch trade. But a hungry customer, not able to wait for his fruit salad with herbal dressing, might snitch one of her apricots. With this in mind, she relapsed into her mama and dada and bolted the door. Alone with her three cats, who liked her sawdust mixed in with their kitty litter, she dwindled down to a few powdery body parts, which her pets mistook for catnip. Very good early morning story. I would like to dedicate this paper to Paul Swenson. He helped me believe that it was possible for me to write. Thank you. Can everyone hear? Doesn't feel... Oh, okay. Why don't you move up a little? There are lots of chairs up here. Okay. Thanks. Okay, I'll try to speak a little louder. The Mormon woman as writer. Excuse me. Oh, I'm sorry. Alone with her three cats, who liked her sawdust mixed in with their kitty litter, she dwindled down to a few powdery body parts, which her pets mistook for catnip. Okay. The Mormon Woman as Writer. This is a quote from an essay called On Rewriting and Practicing the Piano, which appeared in Weber Studies. Once while I was wandering through my life, I had a need to say something. I'm not sure where this something came from, but opinions and observations grew on the interior walls of my mind like lichen, growing into some kind of personal vision that wanted out. As a Mormon child, I listened when my parents and teachers said, "Thou shalt not bear false witness." I wanted to obey, keep the commandments, and speak the truth in every situation, but there were times. Once I told Aunt Martha she had a mustache. My mother whispered crossly, "You don't say things like that." "It's the truth," I said. "Sometimes you can't tell the truth," she said. "People's feelings." This currying of the truth seemed strange. In my mind, the truth was a clearly seen star, but wispy clouds drifted across its face. A complicated duality was seated in my heart and mind. I mourned and sulked for a while, but when, as a teenager, I was tempted to tell the MIA dance director that he was acting like the Adolf Hitler I'd seen in the movies, and for him please to stop because he was turning everyone sour on dancing, I remembered my mother's words. I refrained from speaking, but I couldn't stop the internal war. The director was making things bad for everyone. Dancing and MIA were supposed to be fun. Whatever gave me the right to be judge and jury was a question I asked later, but that is another issue. As I grew older, I started hedging in other situations. I sometimes said I had a testimony when I wanted more than had one. I said things were all right when they weren't. After all, I was a brave child of God. I overlooked irresponsible behavior in my family to present a pretty picture for everyone to see. Little things, simple things, small bricks in a building of self-deception, small masks and small lies smothering the child who once believed in pure truth. And then one day I realized I'd created a second me, a sculpture outside of myself, a clone who was my personal representative to the world. She was nice with groomed hair, kind, responsible, well-loved, obedient, and she tended home fires. The other me inside of me seemed quite different. Sometimes loving, yet sometimes spiteful, sometimes slapping a child, hating the drudgery of the iron skillet broom, and dreaming a more exotic life in a Medusa hairstyle. When this split came to my consciousness, it suddenly seemed bizarre. Why must I walk down the street in tandem when it would be easier just to be myself? Subterraneously, like a blind reptile in a tunnel, I decided to dismantle the sculpture of the idealized me, to bring all parts of myself together again, and to find my voice, not an imitation or an echo. Against my better judgment, I picked up a pen and a pad of paper. I began to write, a dangerous thing to do. Words are unreliable. People can pick them apart and throw them back with their fingerprints on them. I felt nervous, a little afraid. Maybe I should dance, sing, play the piano, or write children's stories where I deal with innocence. Maybe I could speak most eloquently by not speaking at all. But the pen was in my hand. In the act of holding it, I spawned some tentative notions. First, I'd try to look at every question from every angle, not from only one point of view. Second, I'd consider the value of opposites such as bitter and sweet, shadow and light, the heavens and the netherworld. Third, I'd reevaluate the belief that this could never happen to me because I'm a good Mormon, a belief that had come to feel arrogant and uncomfortable. Next, I'd face, rather than avoid, the difficult emotions of hatred, pride, insecurity, fear, loss, desire, self-righteousness, all of which I've known, all of which I've seen outside of myself. And last, I'd admit that my experience of connecting with the divine was closer to poet Anne Sexton's book title, The Awful Rowing Toward God, than the one I'd often heard proposed in church meetings, the glory of the gospel, the united family who sinks to bended knee in common prayer. As much as I wanted to, I couldn't support what I perceived to be an emotional, idealistic, therefore partially dishonest view of the world. This is not to say I'm without sentiment. Part of me believes Cinderella will step into glass shoes and the prince's affections if only she's good enough. And as much as I was tempted to, I didn't want to don the mantle of artiste either, someone who considers herself above humanity or above reproach in the rarefied stratosphere of art. I'm a scribbler, scratching down the events in my line of vision. I see partials. I excel in glances. I paint glimpses of nature in finite detail, not the cosmos. In other words, I don't claim to expound the capital T truth, but rather my capital P point of view about the range of truth I think I see. Writing is the way I've chosen to get back to myself. It is my pick and shovel as I dig out my life and make shapes of it. In this process, I want to speak what I speak, not what someone else tells me I should speak. Otherwise, I'm no more than parrot and plagiarist. I want to stand where I stand, despite all the voices around me, despite my parents, teachers, church authorities, or literary critics poised with the artillery of tradition and righteousness on their side, the shields, the swords, the iron rods, the scriptures, the canon of revered literature. Metaphorically, I want to be brave enough to stand naked in the snow, to live on if someone laughs, ridicules, or says I know nothing. I do consider the voices I hear and pray to find my way through the maze with God's blessings, but only I can bear witness to what I feel and think. I'm the author of my insides as well as the interpreter of external reality. When as an artist, I'm advised by church leaders to give my talent to build God's kingdom and spread the truth of the gospel, what am I being asked? Am I a salesperson, a public relations tool to be edited for the masses? Do I have to paint a rosy picture of all things Mormon, of all things Christian? Am I expected to believe that the rosy picture is the real picture? What about all the blues, grays, and blacks in the palette? Must I maintain a blissful optimism and trust that the hand of God is everywhere? If so, then what of the inevitable questions? What is Hitler? What is Stalin? Jim Jones or Jimmy Swaggart? Is God always good? What is good? What is evil? What is day, light? What is night, dark? Yin, yang, two sides of the same coin? And what about opposition in all things? Whether or not I'm in agreement, beginning with any pre-established truth leaves me little to explore. It is not unlike being asked to extol the virtues of the Cultural Revolution in the People's Republic of China to keep the enterprise in motion and maintain its validity. If I choose not to extol the virtues or to speak a differing view from that of my church, am I expelled or ostracized from the community? This truth-finding is like walking through scraps of pig iron and balancing on uneven surfaces. In his excellent work, The Perpetual Orgy, Flaubert and Madame Bovary, Mario Vargas Llosa compares Bertolt Brecht with Gustave Flaubert. Brecht's plays were written to teach life lessons to his audience. Vargas Llosa describes him as the author who goes over a lesson with his pupils, one that includes a certain number of stories and their morals, a few fables and the exclusive truths that they illustrate. The reader has the message forced upon him, with genius sometimes, along with a story and some characters, and is allowed no escape and no choice. Literature becomes something that demands of the reader the acceptance of a single truth that exists prior to the work of art. In Flaubert's work, Vargas Llosa finds that the truth, one or several, is hidden, woven into the very pattern of the elements constituting the fiction. And it is up to the reader to discover it, to draw, by and for himself and at his own risk, the ethical, social, and philosophical conclusions of the story. Flaubert's art respects the reader's initiative. His technique of objectivity is aimed at reducing to an absolute minimum the imposition of a particular view that every work of art inevitably entails. Obviously, both approaches have validity in the world of literature, but I tend to favor Flaubert's approach in letting the truth weave itself into the pattern, the truth that is discovered in the creative process, not mandated beforehand. As I create something, I'm searching, exploring, letting my creation guide me. If I already know everything, then I close my ears to any new voice, any new character, any new idea that may want to exercise itself. If the matter is already decided, then there's no place for creativity to breathe. Cartesian concept seem pertinent? Is reality made or in the process of making? Does God want us to make additions and corrections to the text, or is everything finished and we're here only as observers? Our main connection to God may be our imagination. Isn't a leap of faith, i.e., a blessed imagination, required to believe in the golden plates, the celestial kingdom, and ultimately the notion of God? If we are, as God once was, beings, and hope to be gods and goddesses, priests and priestesses, then we have the imperative to use our intelligence and creativity to help make this world and future worlds the best of all possible places to live. How many times have you said, if I owned the world, I'd certainly do things differently? You may get your chance. When Czesław Miłosz, the Nobel Prize-winning poet, gave his acceptance speech, he said that many of his friends who had seen their friends die unjustly in World War II had given in to despair. He concluded by saying that artists must help find new solutions, see new visions, and not give in to the prevailing opinions held by the people around them. If any of us think we know all the answers, either in our despair or in our certainty, there's nothing left to explore. If the process is limited to A, B, C, D, then there's no reason to venture forth with a mind to create anything. Creativity implies newness, freshness, new life, new possibilities. So should we not allow ourselves, as artists, access to our wildest imagination to explore this world and the worlds beyond this one? In our attempt to speak with imagination, one of the large challenges for Mormon writers is the Latter-day Saint lexicon. What repertoire of language is available to me if I operate from the stance of active Mormonism? Should a down-and-out character in a novel who sulks in a Western bar be expected to speak Mormon slang because I'm a Mormon writer? If my word processing screen displays words that a good Mormon shouldn't use, do I delete them, blast them off the screen, and flagellate myself? Oh, I said that. Maybe I can blame my word processor, that evil thing, demonic, saying things I'd never say. Maybe I'm under the influence of Satan if I allow stray dog thoughts or words to appear on the page. In a recent discussion, I mentioned to a friend of mine that a character in my first novel took the Lord's name in vain. She answered that she would draw the line when it came to that. What if there are people in the world who speak that way and who would sound foolish if I used gall darn? I'd draw the line, she maintained. Whatever the solution to that dispute, the conversation started me thinking about words that might offend some people in the LDS culture. I took adjectives first. Which adjectives are comfortable? Nice, sweet, gentle, tender, kind, reliable, special, responsible, marvelous, spiritual, generous, loving, soothing, intelligent, cheerful, appropriate, warm. And which adjectives might cause discomfort when applied to a Mormon woman? Angry, mouthy, despairing, grasping, materialistic, intellectual, probing, Socratic, heroic, controversial, sexy, seductive, feminist, bitchy, sleazy, slut, or even worse, obscenities. Discomfort for a Mormon man: power-hungry, adulterous, greedy, lying, seedy, fascist, communist, socialist, hippie, flippant, irrelevant, pig, money-grubbing, abusive, asshole. Oh, good. Thank you for laughing. And more shocking vulgarities I was uncomfortable presenting at this symposium. After all, I'm a special lovely lady. If I create a character who's a Mormon bishop or Relief Society sister and use the uncomfortable adjectives, am I betraying my Maya-made rose-petaled heritage, my religion, and my community? Need I censor myself continually in the event I might offend someone? If so, do I have only a parcel of the language available to me as I write? Many Mormon writers feel pressured to maintain a worshipful attitude toward culturally respected objects and maxims because they don't want their worthiness canceled. If they walk the nervous tightrope of staying in good graces with the church community, at the same time they are challenging the status quo in an objective, even irreverent manner, they run the risk of being labeled unfair, slanderous, heretic, firebrand, smug intellectual. This problem is not peculiar to Mormonism, but is vividly real as in the Ayatollah Khomeini's death threat to Salman Rushdie. Many Muslims, both liberal and conservative, were deeply offended by Rushdie's use of the name Mahound, which has dark implications. Mahound, the prophet of Jahiliyyah, recipient of the revelation in which satanic verses mingle with the divine. Muslims interpreted Mahound to be Muhammad and were offended at the implication that evil could reside in their beloved prophet. The same anger was shouted in 1988 over the film adaptation of Kazantzaki's Last Temptation of Christ. Both authors seem to be asking if the divine ever struggled with human aspects such as temptation and frailty. There is often a literalness in fundamental religion or conservative thought that grounds a wild imagination and flights of language. It is connected to truth-telling, integrity, and telling it straight from the hip, honorable qualities. But the life of the imagination needs to be one of soaring, high altitude, daring. It can't be choked and silenced and grounded every step of the way. Therefore, Mormon writers often worry about readers who choose to travel on B-52s and won't venture into metaphorical flight. They worry about readers who don't differentiate between author and narrative persona. Admittedly, the author is responsible for every word and action that issues forth from the characters. The author wrote those words, after all. But for a reader to make personal moral inventory of an author is another matter. The reader has some responsibility as interpreter of text. Much of the burden lies with the reader who interprets the words. Words are living things, ubiquitous, shifting. Words can be shaped like liquid plastic, and imagination can curve and twist into the warps and cracks as easily as into solid, integrous boxes with squared sides. Ronald Sukenik, an experimental American writer, describes the creation of character as such. You open an awareness into multiple possibilities and multiple levels of personality, and you can be an infinite number of beings. Maybe this all happens in the DNA molecule, where writers and all humans have a connection to every one of their ancestors in the long chain back to the beginning. The honorable, the dishonorable, the indifferent, the heroines, and the pirates. In my opinion, a good writer must assume that people, fictional and in real life, are subject to the entire spectrum of possibility. Human beings are fluid. They are amorphous. They are mortal. They have idiosyncrasies. Should a writer be expected to pretend otherwise? How can I write about the whole range of them if I'm inhibited by decorum? Can my characters scream and rage and sin? Must they sit on a cushion and sew a fine seam, or be characters in a faith-promoting story? Am I obligated to make things work out happily ever after, everyone saved and glowing with gospel light? Or is my imagination free to range through the jungles, forests, mountaintops, and deserts of the human experience? Mormon writers have broken through these barriers, as Levi Peterson has done in The Backslider and many of his short stories, but can't expect to stand in a hallowed circle of light with benevolent faces shining down on them. Writers can't expect to be adored if they challenge the rules. And they shouldn't be surprised if they're shunned by those who misunderstand, misconstrue, or disagree with their stance. Every serious writer needs to remember that taking risk includes the price of admission. There's a prize for belonging and remaining safe. There's a price and a prize for living at the edge. Might I not be freer, therefore, to speak how I speak if I don't call myself a Mormon writer, but rather a person who writes? But then what happens to the Mormon writer who decides to stride out in the world at large and bypass heritage and say, forget that can of worms, I'll just write for people outside of the culture? Writing for the world at large presents an unusual challenge to someone who has been raised on Mormon language, sensibility, and who believes subconsciously that the most important value on earth is the upbuilding of the kingdom of God. If storytelling is rendered through this particular lens, many readers outside of the language and sensibility have no contextual awareness to inform them of the subtlety and nuance, even the high stakes being played out in the story. Steakhouse, bishop, relief society, testimony, temple garments, missionary, endowment, sacrament meeting are foreign words. A character's struggle between obedience to LDS principles and obedience to self, or the struggle with emotions of fear, anger, because of a bishop's interview, these are archaic tempests in a teapot to the outside observer. Someone can say, what about Chaim Potok, Philip Roth, Mary Gordon, Graham Greene, Jewish and Catholic writers? People are interested in them. As I understand it, Judaism and Catholicism are much more universal, much more ancient and puzzling to the public mind than Mormonism, which is often considered a quaint, odd, right-wing cult by many. The main interest in the religion seems to be its oddities, its yellow headlines, the stories of modern-day polygamy, which is all many people know of the religion, Mark Hoffman, and the Singer Clan. So, as a writer who happens to be Mormon, better off addressing a Mormon audience who understands the language and the gallant efforts of members trying to lead a principled life, are Mormon writers trying to write for a larger audience only fooling themselves? Will they just be caught in a crack somewhere, neither in one world or the others, or the other, oddities to both? This is a quote from Alicia Ostreicher. Reticence and good taste are excellent things, but unscrewing the doors from their jams is a good thing too. Our original sin is a tendency to forget that nothing human is alien to any of us. This means that the crazy suicidal lady is not to be condescended to by me. It also means that she is one of the inhabitants of my own proper attic, whom I deny at my peril. I remember my father, who always told me to be kind. He wouldn't allow me to say anything bad about anyone in authority, or anyone else for that matter, unless I could say three nice things. He told me, love one another, and he cried easily when babies were blessed and children confirmed. He was a bishop and on the high council. But I also remember my father in his hair-trigger temper, slapping me in the face and saying, don't you dare cross me, you smartass. I don't remember what I said. I may have plied the knife and salted the wound, but maybe I didn't. Maybe I was caught in the invisible web of his frustration about earning a living and feeding four children and being a saint. Nevertheless, somewhere I learned that saying what I thought was a dangerous occupation. And this is not to say that this is exclusive to Mormonism. I remember the early attempts at writing, being afraid of my own feelings leaking out on the paper. They might be embarrassing. They might prove my unworthiness. They might disgrace me before God. I had to keep reminding myself that I could always throw the paper away. No one had to see what I wrote. But still, I could feel the points of tension in my neck, like talons of an eagle clawing into my upper back. Don't you dare say anything wrong. Be kind, be compassionate, be an example, give everyone the benefit of the doubt. Do unto others. And then I remembered the MIA slogan of the late 50s, dare to be different. But that meant different from everyone else who wasn't Mormon, not different from my Mormon counterparts. I felt the tight girdle of goodness around me. Was there any room to move around on the inside of Mormonism? I reminded myself to say my say, even if it wasn't picture perfect, because if I didn't, all the words in my head would suffocate me. Some of them had to get out. They were crowding me. I could still tear or burn or crumple the paper on which I wrote. Looking at this dilemma directly is painful. I want to be loved by everyone. And if I say something offensive to someone, then I might lose some of the love I need. But I need love from myself too. I want to be unafraid of my reflection in the mirror. So what specific challenges do I face as a Mormon woman writer, even if I now stand at some distance from active participation? Excuse me, once I get started, it's just the worst. I shouldn't feed the tears with water. The woman is the more publicly obligated social servant when the LDS cultural ideal is operative, i.e. the female being married and staying at home to raise children. This is not to say that men don't serve, because they do, but ordinarily they serve by furthering their careers and operating in administrative capacity. In everyday practice, the women are the main characters, caretakers, and the main characters. Because I'm not the major wage earner, whenever I sit down to write, I feel spider webs of guilt being woven in the corners of my study. I should be upstairs in my kitchen baking bread, preparing a meal for a sick neighbor, planning an outing for my children, or finding dead relatives on microfilm. Something important. I shouldn't sit in my study observing people from a distance and writing insignificant stories. I should be making beauty with someone who might need me. Art in the real, not the abstract. Then the spider spins its web furiously around my head. Am I involved in an elevated enough task? Am I furthering the kingdom of God, which is, after all, my main function as a Mormon and as a good person? Sitting in my study, typing, thinking for 3 to 4 hours a day is an unnatural act. I should close down my computer and answer the needs outside my sealed-off, quiet study. The notion of service, that other is my responsibility as well as my salvation, makes it hard to believe in my work. Everything else is more important. Even if I'm providing a service with my writing, it's a very oblique, indirect, and solitary one. And if it's service I'm considering most important, then am I not obligated to write something uplifting rather than depressing or disturbing, which is often the directions of my story? Another challenge to a female writer is the cultural impulse to be a jack of all trades. In my experience, the LDS woman is not encouraged to excel in one area alone. Balance is the more important quality to attain. Excelling in one area is somehow anti-balance. Knowing how to do many things adequately seems to be the sanctioned criteria because, after all, a mother, which again is the most praised role of the LDS woman, needs to be able to perform in all situations, nurse, comforter, baker, canner, secretary, cook, scriptorian, manager, etc. So to me, devoting a good percentage of my day to writing, while I could be learning wok cookery, taking an institute class, learning how to teach my children to manage money, or how to make a quiet book for my baby for sacrament meeting, is a selfish act. Continually, I have to brush little winged creatures off my shoulders who hoot at me while I write and tell me I'm wrong and I'll never amount to anything and I'm silly to think I have something to say when it's all outlined for me if I'd only listen to people who are wiser than myself. Another challenge is that if I succeed at writing, I mustn't be too visible. I mustn't step out where everyone can see me. It's dangerous there. This has been a common dilemma for females, not just LDS women. Traditionally, women are attuned to networking and to the task of holding things together, not to the task of outdistancing others or letting themselves be singled out in the spotlight where it might be very lonely. This didn't bother me while I was writing it. Also, if I'm married, I must consider my husband. If my husband is not successful at his business, then I can't be successful at mine. I must not overshadow him, pull back, stay in the background being the woman behind the man like I promised in the temple. I'm supposed to support him and hold him up when he's in the breach. Oh, thank you. I must always be mindful of his interests, never surge ahead of him as I might make him look inadequate. I also suspect that if I have a best-selling novel, people around me may scrutinize my family life before they clap their hands for me or congratulate me on my work. They'll look to see if my children are well-fed and my husband satisfied with his marriage. And if they or he are not, is the blame with me? Will I be criticized as an ambitious woman who goes after what she wants regardless? And of course, it's wrong to be an ambitious woman, right? Can't there be another mentality open to me, that my success is my husband's success, my failure his failure? After all, his success has been mine, and vice versa for years. Are my talents to be subdued and kept at bay so I will offend no one? Must women keep their power subterranean so as not to frighten, hide their brains so they won't scare off the men, operate at the lowest common denominator of their ability so as to maintain an equilibrium with everything around them? Who told me these things? How crippling for all of us if this is the case. I, as a person, can give the most back to my culture and society when I accept my ability and stop questioning it and stop looking around to see if I've stepped over a wrong line somewhere. There is room for everyone to support everyone else in being the best they can be by being myself. And when I step forward, even if I think something might bite, don't I create more room for others, not just myself? And then I ask myself what all these questions mean. Who am I asking to give me more room? Is it the church? Or is it the punitive me who is intimidated by standing alone and who has drawn so many conclusions about what I can and cannot do? Could it be a little bit of both? There are two ways to victory, to strive bravely or to yield. How much pain the last will save, we have not yet learned. Henry David Thoreau. Now, as a grown woman, I have a complicated history that makes me what I am. Membership in the LDS Church, knowledge of other cultures and religions who do things differently, more than a smattering of humanistic psychology, political science, archaeology, sociology. I've read about religious wars, i.e., people who kill each other for the truth. I've studied literature, writing, music, teenagers, heartbreak, and disillusionment. I grew up in Las Vegas, where the ideal woman, the one most appreciated by the culture at large, seemed to be the one with the most beautiful statuesque body, decorated with the most sequins, feathers, and chiffon. Gentleness and tenderness and quietness seemed to go unnoticed. This is my life, and I can't sort out how much of me is culturally programmed, educated, Mormon, or spontaneously mine. As a woman, I have my feminine perception of the world because I've given birth to four sons. I've watched my stomach stretch to monstrous proportions. I've nursed, I've menstruated, I've surrendered to procreation. I've worn skirts, I've flirted, I've kissed and been kissed. And in truth, I can't claim that I'm more wounded, more special, or more suppressed than any other person. Man, woman, authority, despot, bag lady, immigrant, minority. The human condition is a large enough challenge for each of us without individuals claiming themselves victim. Therefore, I don't wish to blame the men, even though they've laughed me off the baseball field, listened to me politely, and then gone about their more important male business, even though some have told me I can't have the final say about things because there are those with greater access to the truth. Blame feels unfair, even though I've demurred and deferred to the males around me, convinced they did know more because they had been given authority and special favor from God. But God speaks to me too. Don't I have a mind and a bodily manifestation like males, even if I have slightly different equipment? Just because I have breasts and a vagina, am I less spiritual or intelligent than my male counterparts? Does mammary fat drain my brain cells? Maybe God, as he, is a convenient pronoun usage created by linguistics. What if men and women are really two sides of the same coin, daughters and sons, mirror image manifestations of God necessary for the perpetuation of the species? What if God is the embodiment of all things, male and female, not just male? Theological issues aside, what can I do in the everyday realm as a Mormon woman who writes? How can I use my creativity to help find balance for myself and others? Am I caught up in trying to please too much, trying to adapt, smooth ruffles, keep the peace at all costs? Is my notion of connecting people and keeping them together blind to the independence that I and others need at times? Do I always back off my position when challenged by an authority, whether he, she be ecclesiastical or literary? Am I brave enough to stand my ground? I might be brave enough to stand up for my husband and children in troubled waters, but am I brave enough to serve my own personal integrity? And that means I must stand behind my conviction that all of us are co-partners with God as Creator. Therefore, I must expand my awareness, practice my individuation, and not be overly influenced by mass consciousness. And females just might have a different purpose for and a different method of telling. They might have quiet stories to tell, stories apart from the intensity of war, Wall Street, or the Wild West. They may have a different sensibility about dramatic intensity. Their stories and observations have often remained in obscurity because of the impermanent art they've been making in the kitchen, on the table, in hospitals, wherever they might be. Art that is useful, caring, giving to the living rather than to society's notion of greatness. They've learned to make art on small stages, part of the beauty of their art. My particular approach to writing does not always suit my critics, teachers, friends, or husband who wishes I were more practical, commercial. I like to explore time warps, the edges of sanity, impressionism, experimental language, oblique approaches to the subject of humanity. Even though this paper is not particularly subtle, when I write fiction and coax art to life, I like subtlety more than dramatic intensity. I believe the truth is found in small places, not always in heroic epics. I'm attracted to stories with barely discernible plot lines. Maybe this is because I, as a woman, have learned to survive by not being obvious. It threatens me to be seen too clearly. Sometimes I adopt bizarre imagery and situations in my fiction, maybe hiding behind a veil of obfuscation. Maybe this could be considered a female ploy, an invitation to come in and find me. If you love me, you'll do anything for me. It may also be that the fear of censorship is intense and that conventional use of the language seems too trite, boring, or shallow to carry the expression of my feelings. If I had my way, I'd rather speak with my hands, dance wildly, sing the things for which there are no words, probably more honest ways of telling. But for some unknown reason, I've accepted the role of writer. Therefore, I need to accept the profession's demands. I need to accept the task of reading, studying, thinking, learning traditional logic, even though it opposes the way I know and understand things, learn the rules of the craft just as I would with a musical instrument. I need to have these tools, much as I'd like to do without them and do everything my way, which is much more interesting. So, I refine, refine, and then refine again. Observe the rules of character, plot, and setting until I can't stand them anymore. And then a little flash of inspiration comes and I remember why I'm writing. It's all about that personal vision. All about speaking how I speak. I'm the only one who can do that. Then I cross my fingers and hope I can speak clearly enough for someone to hear. For someone to be moved by my words, as I have been moved by others who've chosen to write. Does anyone have a comment or some questions? Bella said that she would be willing to. Why don't you sit there? Yes.
I have one. As a woman who has postponed her writing because of economic necessity for many years, I have now had my word processed, so I'm going to get into writing. And because I was involved in the Federal Women's Program for Women in the government for 15 years, those are the things that are dear to my heart that I want to write about. And here in this moment culture, I'm treading a very delicate line, trying to feel my way as to what would be acceptable and how to get into, you know, in a writing that will be published in this community. Do you have a suggestion?
In the spirit of what I've just said, I'd say write about what really matters to you. And to worry about being accepted is a real big hindrance. I hope that I said that in the paper. I think it was Heber Woolsey. Is there somebody named Heber? I'm getting old. Can't remember. I heard him speak at a writer's conference a long time ago, and I really appreciated the one thing he said. He said, if you want to be a writer and you're Mormon, go succeed outside of the Mormon culture first. And then you will be asked to come back into the Mormon culture, which has happened for me. I mean, I'm really honored to be here today. I would never have thought I would, you know, in my dingbat days, be asked to be at Sunstone Symposium. But I went out and I did it in the national literary magazines and things like that. So you do what matters to you. Don't worry about whether you're going to be accepted or not.
Well, that's what I got to find on Parker Drive, because that's what's important to me.
Yeah, and that is what will mean something to other people, because it means something to you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I ought to be content I'm supposed to be admitted into this company of women, but you spoke about so many problems that are universal to all Mormon writers, not just women.
Yeah.
With the exception of the guilt that you feel as a married woman.
Right.
I think Mormon writers all struggle with the problem of orthodoxy.
Mm-hmm.
If I were to write over in my heart, I'd be released from all my church positions.
Mm-hmm.
and I'm a public communications director for a region.
Mm-hmm.
But I did write a play once that the theaters in San Francisco rejected as true Mormon, and BYU rejected it because it was not Mormon enough.
That's what I was trying to say, that we get, you're an oddity. I've got a novel in New York with a New York agent. Not commercial enough. Not a blockbuster. Too quiet. I mean, that thing is not quiet. It's got Mormonism in it. There's just seething things going on, but people don't get it. You know.
But I have a question that goes to the heart of what you opened with. Do you feel uncomfortable creating characters characters and situations that are not telling the truth?
In fiction, that you never tell the truth.
I know. Are you uncomfortable with that?
Sometimes, but if you're really remembering that it's fiction, and not most Mormon readers don't remember it's fiction, they say, oh. Oh, I know she did that. Yeah. But I try to close. What I do is I close my eyes and I try to let the character do the talking, not my Mormon inhibitions, because characters will come and talk to you. I think, and if you'll give them rein. But again, if you're writing with this around you, like, it's very hard.
Maybe the list of adjectives that you made that is a good way of overcoming the inhibition. I would probably like to see if I get a copy.
Well, one thing I suggest is the first thing I wrote for dialogue was a book review. I can't remember the name of the book now. I really can't remember things anymore. But he happened to be the son of a general authority, and he was a psychologist, and it was like I was going, I'm just the little old woman, you know, and here's the general authority's son and all that, and what do I have to say? And so I went into I read the book, and I had some feelings about it. So I just said, okay, I'm in my little safe bedroom here, and I'll write exactly what I think, exactly what's on my mind, and I can always tear it up. So I ended up using that particular draft. But what I suggest is writing what's in your heart. I mean, really write, and you may or may not get excommunicated or whatever, but don't be afraid of yourself. If you're censoring yourself in your own bedroom or your own study, then you're not going to get very far. So I suggest in a first draft just letting everything blow out. I know some writers who will have a shawl or a special sweater or something, they'll put that on. Kind of empowers them in that way. That's nice, Marty.
I'll come up here. This is going to be a lengthy. I'll just go sit down.
When I was at BYU, I took a speech class in which one of the assignments was to read a narrative poem. Being a Canadian, I chose a poem by a fellow Canadian, Robert Service. I think it was The Shooting of Dan McGrew, one of these nice little la-di-da poems, and it makes for nice narrative bounce. There was in there a line in which one of the characters in the poem is describing the lady that's known as Lou, and he says, "Oh Lord, how she looks so pale." Well, I read the poem, not thinking anything of it, and was immediately called on the carpet by my professor, who condemned me for taking the Lord's name in vain. At the age of 17, this was rather hard on me, you know, to think. I said, immediately retaliated, said, I wasn't doing it. I was reading someone else's words. He said that was the same thing and went on to also call on the carpet any actor in the church who had ever played a part in which they had also used vulgar language or taken the Lord's name in vain, saying that they should not do this. Well, at the time, you know, this was 30 years ago, and in the improvement era, Joseph Fielding Smith used to write a column where he answered questions. So I thought, well, this man knows the church, and he can help me. So I wrote him a letter and explained the situation, and I said, I don't feel that I was doing anything wrong. Can you tell me? And I have since lost the letter he wrote me back, but the first words he said are indelibly engraved on my heart, and I will never forget them. And, almost failed the class when I read the letter, I think. But he said, "Let us not stand up so straight that we lean over backwards." Those words endeared President Smith to me, definitely. And I have always remembered that in my acting. I'm a character actress, and I find that some of the best parts are not the best people. And in my writing, if I'm not writing about Mormons, why should they have to behave like Mormons? And I feel that those words of President Smith have guided me in my writing and in my life, that I have to remember that everyone does not share my values. And why should I pretend that even villains, I mean, there must be opposition in all things. I can't always write about nice little people. And I agree with Phyllis that you can't make your people just nice. The people have to be the way they are. The characters have to grow from within, and they have to tell you what they are like. And therefore, you know, you have to be true to your character. I think Phyllis is wrong when she says fiction is not truth. It might not be, what's going. It's truer. It's truer than truth, because your characters speak definite truths. Thank you.
Okay.
Phyllis and I are old friends. I'm a writer, too. I teach at BYU in the communications department.
And during the summertime, I teach an English class. And one of the things that I tell my students in that English class is that writing is also a stewardship. I think that if you have that calling, you are as obligated to that calling as you are to making plastic grapes and things like that. Going to
this. That is Jade. That's Jody. Jody, Jane, Rebecca, Jennifer. I used to teach them all piano lessons. So.
Now she's teaching us writing. My comment and question is, I don't think in my best and yet most outrageous thoughts about writing, I could write anything as negative a presentation as some of the things that have been said to me by self-righteous Mormons or by people who proclaim themselves to be my leaders and yet are anything but Christian. And I guess they would also be the ones who, if I did write things that weren't perfectly down the line, would excommunicate me from the church. But I think, you know, I really appreciate what you were saying about how you need to write about yourself and what's really, well, what's important to you. The problem is, in listening to your paper, that helped a lot, but at what point are you able to look at this and say, yes, this really is me? This is what's important to me. Is there...
Well, that's a lifelong process. Jeez. And I was, like, going over this paper. I wrote it 3 months ago, and I was going over it, and I thought there were some things. I thought, oh, no, you know, I don't believe that I'm not here anymore. So you're continually fluid. That's no help. But... I had someone say to me lately, who's a really national, well-known writer, and he says, you are the strongest woman I've ever met. And I was kind of going, wow, you know. Because I have always seen myself as this big mass of jelly, you know. But what I think he saw was my willingness, and which I've dedicated myself to, and it's gotten me in hot water sometimes, but my willingness to continually tell the truth about what's going on inside of me, and not to bang anybody over the head with, but to say, you know, I really feel uncomfortable when this is happening. So by me going to my deeper truth, always asking what's... And even when... I mean, even in a group of environmentalists, you know, that's really scary to go in environmentalists because that's a righteous cause, you know, and we believe in nature and everything like that. But sometimes some of those people have... So I'm talking about every situation you're in, not just in Mormonism, but quietly. And you don't have to, again, bat people over the head and say, you're wrong. But stick with your deepest feelings and your deepest truth. And if you keep doing that, it starts to show, and you start to know who you are, I think. Does that answer that well enough? Hi, Carla. How are you?
This is just a short comment. I just want to say that I'm very much looking forward to reading your novel. So, it's got a break.
Thank you.
She mentioned William Faulkner being inspired by a girl's muddy drawers and the tree. And that's sort of, I've got all these things in my mind. But then when I sit down to write, it's so hard to keep myself going and not feel like I'm doing something silly. And you mentioned a little bit about that. And I was wondering what kept you going, what kept you from stopping and keep on going.
Every other day I say I'm going to quit writing. That it's the stupidest thing anybody could possibly do. I spoke out at the prison and talked to the prisoners. I said, if you feel rejected by society already, don't write. It's a bad idea. But I had a real big aha the other day, which may or may not be useful to you, but I really have been a pleaser, and I've really had to have people like me a lot. And so I thought, well, and writing is about, I'd say, maybe 70-80% rejection. It's fishing. You go fishing. But so I said, well, I can use this as a tool to help me learn how to live with non-acceptance. And that's a killer. That's really a killer. Everybody loves me, right? I'm so nice and I'm so sweet. Well, you know, that's so, I use it as that. So when I started looking at it like that, I said, okay. But as far as keeping going, writing, I think you need, one thing that helps me is I have a great community of writers and writers' friends. all over the country, and we correspond with each other, and they say, how are you coming? You know, and I'll say, I'm discouraged, and they'll say, you keep going. So what I suggest is that you get a writer's group going of some kind. You find a group of friends, good writers, I mean, and good critics. Get so you can hear what people have to say about your work. And don't ask your husband or your child, because most of the time they haven't done enough writing or reading, you know, to really be good critics. So find a group of writers, and also look at it as fun. You know, I'm going down, I say, this is my time to play, and I'll go down and have the best time I can. But, you know, get somebody you can call and say, I'm really discouraged. Should I keep writing? Do I have any talent? And don't wait for somebody to say, oh, you're the best writer I've ever read, you know, because they most likely won't. So you have to get that on your own steam going, but do get a group to help you. Or take classes in a university. I teach an independent workshop. You know, there are groups around, but get some support.
I have more of a fear of being taped, so I don't know if
you found what? I understand. I think that it depends on the individual, and I don't feel like I have quit the church. I think that's something that might be a burden for you to carry in that way. I'm really grateful for audiences like this, for some.